The statute has been in existence since 1862, and until January of this year, it was always interpreted to mean if you can't tell, you give the appellant a new trial. And interestingly, there's a federal statute, 28 U.S.C. Section 391, which is virtually identical to the state statute. And the rule, as interpreted by the United States Supreme Court still today, is the rule that existed prior to the decision in Shoup. So I don't think it's true that under PGE versus Boley, you can look at the statute and say, well, it's obvious that the result in Shoup is the right result. It may be the right decision or not, but our position is simply that it should be applied only to people that have not previously relied on the old rule to the detriment of their clients.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Ringo.
Mr. Perry, let's just assume for a minute that you did somehow rely on the rule to your detriment and then the court changed the rule. I mean, that happens a lot when the Supreme Court comes out with a new ruling, where they put a new spin on existing law, or they, in some ways, they make new law, and people can go back from 2 years, 5 years, 10 years earlier and say, well, gee, you know, if that law had existed when I had my complaint before the court, I would have had a different result. And now, you know, why shouldn't I get the benefit of the new court ruling? You know, and those examples never end. And so I'd just like to hear from you as a matter of policy. Why should we give you and your client special dispensation when on other circumstances and for other court cases, we don't?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, thank you. I should point out, first of all, that in none of the three cases that are sitting on my desk was I the trial lawyer, so that's why I didn't say I knew about the tendency of the Shoup case. It was trial counsel that had to make the tactical decision. And I think that you're right, and your counsel is right in saying the law is a fluid institution and it changes, and we all have to adapt to the changes. But the court itself has recognized for almost 100 years that when you're talking about changing procedural rules after people have tried cases in reliance on those rules, generally they don't apply them to cases that have already been tried. And the reason is because people make tactical decisions that are influenced by those rules. And so it's not simply that, gee, the rule changed and I should get dispensation, but the rule changed and I relied on the old rule in the way that we formulated our trial strategy. And it is unfair to my client to now penalize him or her because the attorney relied upon the rules as they existed.
Yes, but that doesn't make you different than anybody else where the courts changed the rule. And they didn't have the benefit of the new rule. You do want the benefit of the new I'm sorry, but...
No, I want the benefit
of the old. Yeah, you want the benefit of the old rule, but you don't want to be impacted by the new decision.
That's correct, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo. And what makes me different is that I relied upon the old rule. Now, somebody that goes to trial today didn't rely upon the old rule, and so there's nothing unfair about applying the new rule to that person.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, but in other contexts, whether it's interpreting contract law, for example, people can say, I relied on the old rule, and obviously this comes up pretty seldom. I mean, there aren't that many times where the court comes out and dramatically changes the rule, but when it does happen, I mean, you just can't go back and say, well, gee, there's a whole bunch of people that were relying on this. I mean, it's, in some ways, it's just that's the way things fall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, you're right. It doesn't happen all that often. It especially doesn't happen all that often that the court overturns 100 years of precedent. And when it does, its normal practice is to do exactly what I'm asking you to do through this amendment, which is to apply the rule only to new cases. Why it chose to do otherwise in this case is a little bit of a mystery to me. Your comment about contract law, of course, parties to a contract get to agree on what the rules are going to be that govern that contract. And while I'm sure we could come up with an example of a situation where somebody is disadvantaged by a change in the law in contract, most of the time these situations arise with regard to a rule of procedure in a trial or appellate court, where somebody is playing the game according to the rules, and then after the fact they get changed. And that's really what this amendment is addressing.
Mr. Gary, I want to kind of interject something, because it seems to me that in the Shoup case, Walmart Mart Stores was also relying on the prior interpretation. And the Supreme Court basically shoved it in their ear and said, no, here's the new rule. Correct?
That's correct.
So why then should we do something contrary to what the Supreme Court chose?
Well, first of all, you should do something contrary if you think that what they did is not fair. That's the nature of separation of powers. But secondly, unlike...
Mr. Gary, you're not... You know, it would be a different question if you were asking the legislature whether or not the opinion of the Supreme Court is the opinion that the legislature holds. And that's not the question that has been raised here. The question that you raise is, should we apply the old rules to these several cases that are still in process and in litigation? You're not asking us whether or not we agree with the Supreme Court should change that rule.
Right. And I have a lot to say about the rule, but I'm not asking you to address that. I'm only asking that you not apply it to cases that were tried before it was announced. And there's a reason for that, which is that I think the rule itself is extremely complicated. Its ramifications are very broad, and it was my judgment that it was, at this point in the session, unwise to come to you and ask you to open that kettle of fish. However, there's one thing that's different about the position that my clients are in and other people who are in my position and the Shoup case, and that is Shoup was decided by the Court of Appeals. At the time that the cases that I'm dealing with were tried, the decision was the Court of Appeals decision. And in the Court of Appeals decision, the Court of Appeals was asked to hold that a person in my client's position should have asked for a special verdict. And the court rejected that, and they said the duty, the obligation to ask for a special verdict is the plaintiff's obligation in that situation, not the defendant. And this is a quote: the defendant need not do anything. Now, that was the rule at the time I tried the case. That wasn't the rule as explicit as that is stated at the time that the Shoup case was tried. So while the Shoup plaintiffs were relying on the old rule, they didn't have the benefit of a Court of Appeals decision in that very case that said, you don't have to do anything, defendant. It is perfectly okay for you to sit back and allow this to go forward with a general verdict. And that was clearly in my client's interest. I was relying on what the Court of Appeals said,
right,
and now you've changed the rules. And that's what makes it different from Shoup.
I'm reading from Shoup, second to last paragraph. It says, in this case, however, defendant objected to plaintiff's proposed special verdict form. So although you say the defendant has to do nothing, the plaintiff did offer a special verdict form. The defendant chose to object to that. And then the court goes on and says, we agree with the plaintiff that the record doesn't demonstrate that the jury based its verdict on an invalid specification. The defendant, therefore, is unable to show that the trial court's error substantially affected the defendant's right. And then they apply ORS 19-415 sub 2, BGE Bully, strict language, bang, you're out. I just don't understand why it is that you would ask the legislature in these several cases to change what the court did, in my opinion, intentionally. They're very smart people over there. They knew the ramifications of what they were doing, and they chose to apply it to everyone.
Mr. Chair, first of all, let me say that whether the court chose to apply it to everyone is an issue that I'm litigating at this moment. So I do not concede that under Shoup the rule clearly applies to cases tried beforehand. So I'm, you know, I'm here asking for you to make the decision that, as a matter of fairness, it should not apply to people whose cases were tried beforehand for the reasons that I've stated.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Brady.
Can you give me an example? Because we're only talking, I just want to be clear, we're talking about the universe of cases that have gone through the trial court phase and are now awaiting appeal. Is that correct?
Cases that were tried before the effective date of SHOOP.
In the trial court?
Yes.
And that are either in the Court of Appeals now or are awaiting appeal. Is that correct? Okay. So you said that in previous situations, the Supreme Court has not applied rule changes to cases that are in this situation. Do you have any examples of that?
Yes. There's a case called Falk against Amesbury, which is a 1981 decision, 290 Oregon 839. I'm sorry, I can't tell you what the facts of that case were, but what the court said was, ordinarily we do not apply a new procedural requirement to cases tried prior to the adoption to the detriment of litigants who have justifiably relied on the overruled precedent. That is also, there's a case called U.S. National Bank versus Wagner, which is a Court of Appeals opinion to the same effect.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, in the SHOOP case, what is it about the SHOOP case that does apply? Did they specifically say, I didn't see anything where they specifically said, I might have missed it, but why does the SHOOP case apply? Is it by specific or by failure to not apply it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think the reason that one can conclude from SHOOP that it's applied to cases like my client's situation is because they applied it to SHOOP. Now, as I pointed out, my clients are in a different position, and I have an argument for why it should not be interpreted to apply to my clients. But I don't think you'll find anything more in the opinion that says that it's applied retroactively other than the fact that they applied it in that case.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, would the court even have been able to change the rule if they thought it needed to be changed without applying it to SHOOP? How could that have worked?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, they can and they have done that in the past simply by saying, we think this rule is bad, but we're not going to reverse in this case because the litigants relied on it. But in the future, the rule will be interpreted differently. They could have done that.
They've done that before in this Bob versus Amesbury.
Yes. That's right.
Right. Other questions, Senator Ringo?
I mean, based on that, it seems like you really are asking us to interfere with the decision-making process of the Supreme Court. I mean, they could have changed the rule, but not in a way that would have impacted your pending cases, and they chose not to.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I really don't think I'm asking you to interfere with the decision-making process. I see it as the court has issued its decision. It is interpreting a statute adopted by this body, and this body, as you know, often says, well, we disagree with the way the court has interpreted our statute and has changed it. I have not gone that far in my request. I'm just saying, now that they have issued their decision, I'm coming to you to ask you to do what, in my view, is the fair thing to do with regard to cases that came before.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rigo.
When in the SHOOP case, when the defendant sought the general verdict form, they specifically did not want the jury to fill out its rationale for arriving at the decision. The special form would have been more specific and would have provided more information as to how the jury arrived at its decision.
Right.
And the defense specifically didn't want that to happen. Isn't that right?
I believe that's true.
And I mean, if you want the outcome to truly reflect what the jury was thinking, I mean, you would want a special verdict form, wouldn't you? I mean, if you want to implement what the jury thought, you would desire the special verdict form.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, my view on that is that if I'm representing a litigant in a trial, what I want is the verdict form that is in that client's best interest.
I understand you made that tactical decision, but if we're here talking about fairness, you want us, this panel, to pass an amendment because of fairness. I mean, fairness would be implemented what the jury wants, what the jury is thinking. At least that's what I would say.
Your
view of fairness is what is tactically, you know, with what the rules said, you could tactically take advantage of. But I guess my view of fairness would be, how did the jury view the evidence, and what would they have decided? And when the defense specifically did not want to allow the jury to reveal its analysis, I don't think that's fair.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Ringo, I guess there are different kinds of fairness. Ultimately, what we want is a fair result in the case, and we all agree with that. The litigants probably, I mean, each thinks that the fair result is they win,
right?
And that influences the way that they try the case. But the problem here, bear in mind, is that if you have a general verdict, it isn't that you're not giving effect to the verdict of the jury. The problem is that if there was error, you can't tell whether that error affected the jury's decision. I think that it's clear that the Supreme Court has a strong preference expressed in Shoup for a special verdict. And that's why, I mean, it is fairly debatable whether that is the correct and better rule than the rule that they threw out. My only point is that it isn't fair in a procedural sense to tell me that the rules are X and then to say, but now they're going to be Y.
Well, I guess I'm not really going to argue with that, but if you're here asking for fairness in the larger context, I think fairness means implementing what the jury wanted to do. And you would know that if you had a special verdict form.
Sometimes you do and sometimes you don't, depending on how well you craft the special
All
verdict
right.
form.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burke.
Why wouldn't the remedy here be to retry the cases that were, to retry them under the new rules?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I think they should be retried under the new rules, but only if, I'm not asking that you send them all back to be retried, but only if the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court ultimately concludes that there was an error in submitting something to the jury, and they can't tell whether that error had an impact on the fairness of the proceeding. In that situation, then all we would get if you pass this amendment is a new trial, and only if we can demonstrate that we would be entitled to a new trial under the old rule as it existed when we tried these cases. And that's all we're asking for.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Gary.
Thank you very much.
All right. The chair is not going to support the Dash 7 amendment. I think the question that should have been submitted to the legislature was whether or not the legislature agrees with the interpretation of the Supreme Court in this application. We can set the work session over and send this out to the bar and have them go twiddle their thumbs for a week or so and see what they think. Bring us back an argument as to why they think it ought to be changed. But I really don't have the tolerance for that right now.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I would like to do that.
You'd like to do what?
To let the bar look this over. And
well, this is a law commission bill. We got the law commissions out there. I don't know whether. Wendy, come on up here for a second. Maybe we ought to delve into the questions of whether or not the bar and the law commission really asked that question. And this case came down in January of this year. Have there been discussions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. This issue came to us very late in the session. We'd already been through the House. We took a look at the issue and decided it was a substantive issue that our judgments work group composed of many members of the state bar. In various sections of the bar, we took a look at the issue and decided it wasn't one that we had addressed, and we decided not to take a position nor poll our work group members on the issue. We're hoping to move the bill along, and we don't want an amendment that's going to obviously stop our bill, so that's kind of where we're stuck at. We'd be happy to take it.
Do you think it would be profitable to hold this off for a week and get all of the certified smart lawyers in this area to talk about it? Would we come up with something productive? Or would we still be arguing a week from now?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's an obvious policy decision that's going to be coming back down to, you know, the question of is it fair or not. I'd be happy to wait, but I think you're still going to have to make that big policy decision.
All right.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
There might be another way. Maybe we could send this bill along and look for another vehicle to address this issue. You know, it's just a thought. I mean, if this is not one of those things we can just leave till next session because it pertains to things that are on the roof now. So, maybe we could look for another.
I guess I'm of the opinion that the Supreme Court knew exactly what it was doing. They've changed the landscape and interpretation of the rule. And the question, I think, before the legislature is whether or not we agree or disagree. That's a very complex question. The case came down in January. It seems to me that there's been ample time for the parties to talk about whether or not the court's wisdom was in fact something that they agreed with or not. I don't see a group of individuals in front of me arguing one side or the other. I see several individuals who have interested parties that have cases on appeal were affected.
Yeah, and I would feel better too with that, just straight up, did the rule make sense or not? I mean, we've done that before where we've disagreed with the interpretation. To me, that's a much cleaner thing to do, and I don't know quite why that isn't before us because of the timing, but I guess what I'm struggling with is I think the case was made that if you're a lawyer in a court proceeding and you're operating under a certain set of rules, it would not be appropriate representation of your client to take a strategy that would fit under a set of rules that don't exist at that particular time. In other words, I think it would be an ethical issue for lawyers to try a case under assumptions that did not yet exist. And that's what I'm struggling with.
Right. And I mean, I don't disagree with that, except to say that the Walmart stores, who are the defendant in this case, applied those same theories on the previous strategies. And the court said no. So for us to stand now and say we're going to allow the several other plaintiffs who are in line to appeal their cases and then apply a different rule than the court applied to a similarly situated corporation, I think would be wrong unless the legislature actually asked the question as to whether or not they agreed with the interpretation of the Supreme Court in Orris 1945. Yeah. Senator Ringo.
Yeah, I guess also I think it does matter what the jury is trying to do. And people who object to a special verdict form and insist on a general verdict form, they do so because they don't want more information on the jury's thinking process. And so I have a hard time thinking they're here for fairness when they're the ones who were specifically maneuvering to keep out the jury's analysis.
Yeah, but on the other side, their job is to represent their client.
I know.
And if that's the rules of the game, then they're representing their client appropriately. If I was a client, I'd want everything done.
But I just point out that behind these arguing lawyers, there are clients who have a lot at stake here, and they're the real parties that are being whipsawed through these legal changes. And if they're the ones we ought to be applying a fairness test for, not the lawyers or the clients.
It's the same. I mean, if the lawyer loses something on this, it's the client that loses.
I'm just saying that the defense didn't want a special verdict form because they didn't want the information from the jury as to how they were analyzing the case.
They felt that that was in the best interest of their client. They were representing their client as they were hired to do. That's what I'm struggling with here.
And then they lost.
Lawyers are doing their job, under the ground rules of the time, if they'd done something else, they could be accused of not representing their client to the best of their ability. That's what I'm struggling with here.
Okay. Right. Senator Walker?
Well, I agree with Senator Ringo. They made a choice, and Senator Burdick believes they made a choice under the law at the time, which may be true, but they lost. They went to the Supreme Court. They lost again because the court changed the rule. Well, a good lawyer knows what's on appeal at the time, and a good lawyer isn't, no matter how good they are, they're never going to be able to see into that crystal ball of the Supreme Court's minds and say, yeah, you're going to change this 100-year-old rule. I don't know why they decided to change the rule. I mean, they did. They reasoned it very well. But for us to come here with this -7 amendment and say, well, we're not going to apply your rule, Supreme Court, to all these other cases.
And I guess my thinking is, following that logic, we would be, by statute, reversing the Supreme Court for several cases on appeal. And we don't have the power to reverse the Shoup case, necessarily.
Actually, we do.
Well, in a different form. I mean, if we chose to change the statute, but we haven't heard the arguments in favor of one side or the other.
And, Mr. Chair, you pointed out the Shoup case came out in January. These amendments are here for the first time. They didn't even come up in the House. Why didn't they come up with a bill? Why didn't they do something on their own instead of here on June 23rd or June 18th when I first saw these come before us now and tack it on to this bill? I don't think it's appropriate. And I don't want to give it out to the bar for a week to mull over and look at, because I think it's a bigger issue than a week issue, a 7-day issue for the bar to take a look at. And I don't want to hold this bill up.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I agree with Senator Walker. I don't want to hold this bill up either. I would still like to hear more on some basis, whether it's another vehicle or just an informational.
Who's here from the bar?
Analysis.
From the bar?
Senator, Mr. Chair, may I add, there was a bill on the House side that did have this amendment on it. It did not move out of Judiciary Committee.
It did not move, did Mr. Chair, could I ask, Ms. Johnson,
sure.
Did it have discussion in the House Judiciary Committee?
I'm not aware of that. The discussion was not a part of that bill. I just understand that this is where that amendment came. It's virtually identical to that amendment.
Okay. There you go.
Well, maybe it's the conversation with the chair of the House Judiciary Committee.
It was coupled with a Gladhart decision, actually. It was a Shoup and Gladhart together.
Okay.
And now this has been parsed out.
I think that would be 20.
Okay.
208 out.
All right. We're having fun now. All right. We have conflict amendments, or
no, Mr. Chairman. We have the -A6s, which are a combination of technical amendments from LC and the Law Commission. -A6.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Well, I was just going to refresh the committee. The -6s have those conflict amendments, and also have the issue that I was concerned about, and that is implementing a $4 fee for the attorney to issue a writ of garnishment. And I've spoken to several people on this issue. And I guess, first of all, it kind of troubles me that this is put in as a part of an Oregon Law Commission bill, because I think it does, there are broader implications here. The rationale, at least as far as I can tell, the chief rationale is currently if the court issues a writ of garnishment, they will charge a $4 fee for that service, and then they can add that $4 onto the garnishment, and so that I guess it's the obligee is the person who eventually has to pay it. Well, right now, because of budget problems, some courts are not issuing writs of garnishment, and so it does seem unfair that somebody could have done it for $4 to the court, now they have to go hire an attorney, and there's an added expense there. So I understand the rationale, but it does seem to me that we're putting a little bit more burden onto the debtor here, and that concerns me. So I guess I'm somewhat conflicted, and I'm not going to oppose this. I would be more comfortable with it if it
maybe at sunset when our bunch of problems were solved or when courts were back in the business of issuing garnishments, because I think really that's the purpose of for the $4 is because it was the court service fee in essence. And so we're expanding that. So anyway, that's just my ramblings on that $4 issue.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question of my colleague of the $4 comments? That's not on top of the court $4. It would be an alternative. Right?
Yeah, and my understanding is the original $4 was kind of a court fee. You go to the court to perform a service, and they'll fill out the garnishment, and they charge $4 because that's what government does. They charge a fee for things. But attorneys right now can issue writs of garnishment just on their own signature, and they have the power to do that, but they don't get to add $4 onto the total amount owing. And this lets them add $4 onto it.
All right. Now, currently, this allows attorneys to issue writs of garnishment.
Well, our attorneys already can.
They already can do that. Okay.
And this allows them to get $4 for doing so.
All right. Great. So where are we? Anybody going to move to dash six?
Okay, Mr. Chairman,
sit on this Easter bunny.
I want to get rid of this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Burdick moves the A6 amendment. What the heck house bill is this? 2646. Any gross? Any further discussion? Any objections? Motion passes. On the A7, I think I'll have a discussion with Representative Williams in the House to issue a committee chat with him about the Shoup case and why his committee didn't take that specific issue up. I don't know that it's in the 2080.
Yeah, I don't recall discussing the issue in the House, and it just may be passage of time, but I don't remember.
I mean, we're going to be here until August or September anyway.
Yeah. You've got plenty
of time, but.
Keep talking like that, I will not move this bill.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I move House Bill 2646 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2646 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? No objection. Motion passes. And I'll carry this thing. This ought to be fun. What is he talking about? We'll see who actually reads it. Roger Byer will read the entire thing, I'm sure. All right. We're going to take just a 5-minute recess real quick. We'll be back.
Can we do
2308? Not sure how you want to go through this. You've organized most of the amendments and the various bills.
Mr. Chairman, we've got two tobacco-related bills. And what you had asked me to kind of, since we haven't dealt with these for a few days, maybe do a little review of the two bills and then go through the amendments we've got.
And then we'll move into work sessions.
Okay. The first bill numerically is 2094. And I'm going to make sure everyone's got that. Pete Shepard did a section by section analysis. I should say that Pete and I both did a section by section. As I'm used to, he outshone me a little bit and did a better job. So, but there's no shame in that, I assume. But let me go through these real quickly. 2094 is the bill that came to us from the House Judiciary Committee. And this is the bill that deals with, I would say, primarily dealing with certifying non-participating manufacturers. And dealing with the relationship between master settlement agreement and the non-participating. If you have Pete's section by section, we can go through the bill. I'll try to make it brief. Section one is just a finding that to keep the integrity of the master settlement agreement and keep we need to keep track of violations of the escrow accounts or any violations of the master settlement agreement. Section 2 deals with Section 2 and 3, I would say, make sure that the AG's office has good numbers for cigarettes sold so that you have definitions of a brand family, which would be, you know, say you had Ringo 100s, Ringo lights, and Ringos.
Whoa.
Just a hypothetical. That you would have a brand family, and then we would be able to, then have a certification by the non-participating manufacturers of all those brand families and how many, what numbers they do in selling them. This is all kind of to help in our keeping track of the number of cigarettes sold. The next section, section 4, deals with the escrow funds, and we've heard some, you may recall we've heard about this, escrow funds and escrow accounts for the non-participating manufacturers. This deals with how that is set up, how the AG's office is kind of reviewing and approving those. Section 5 deals again with numbers, makes clear that the manufacturers are to retain invoices and documentation for sales so the AG can review those, I think is the idea behind that. Section 6 goes again into the escrow account. What would make something not be qualifying? For example, in Section 6, subsection 3, we have this concept of a directory list. And a directory list is a list of all the tobacco companies, basically, that then that are in compliance with these sections, that then these are the only manufacturers that you can, as a distributor, affix the tax stamps to, meaning you can't sell anything but the ones that are on the directory, basically. This would make sure, and it again deals with the escrow accounts, so you can be part of this directory list, and makes it clear that they have to be in good standing on the escrow payments, that there can't be any outstanding judgments, and would basically make this distributor list available for people to use as distributors. Section 7 deals with having a resident agent of the state if you're a foreign corporation or business. Obviously, the idea is so we can have someone to serve process on, someone to that would facilitate any litigation, et cetera, of a non-participating. Section 8, again, more making sure that there are numbers and compliance numbers with the persons. When a distributor affixes a stamp or on a cigarette package, they're going to report this information to the AG's office to facilitate compliance with the tobacco product manufacturers, and to give what they call a stick count for the ones that are roll your own. Section 9 would allow the AG's office to have require a non-participating manufacturer to make quarterly installments into the escrow deposits, and could also, to help facilitate compliance, would allow rulemaking so that they could, be more and less lenient on the tobacco companies that are in compliance with this escrow account. Section 11 is the portion that says that you can only affix a stamp on the ones that are in the directory. I believe it says it in the negative. You cannot put one on one that is not in the directory. And I hope that I've made, the directory again is the ones that are in compliant, the ones that are giving reports, the ones that have their escrow accounts. Then you get on this list that is promulgated by the AG's office, and this is a list of the manufacturers that you can that you can sell, because those are the ones you can put stamps on. Section 12 is the remedies, the civil penalties for violation of would be for the distributor. So if you're a person who sells cigarettes that are not on the directory or not stamped, you did something wrong there, that's the civil remedies. 13 is 14 are I think self-explanatory. Section 15 adds to RICO portion about distributors in the directories, so that they could be a part of it would be a RICO predicate. Section 16 is the forfeiture list that has that the forfeiture stuff is related to. Forfeiture stuff, that's a great legal term. But this is the statutory enactment after the ballot measure that passed the property rights ballot measure last session. This is what we worked on. And this is a list of the crimes that are subject to the new criminal forfeiture. Section 17, again, this is the thing that the statement of requiring you to be working from the distribution list. Section 18 makes it unlawful trade practice to violate this distributor, you know, selling if you're not on a distributor list. And also 19 does as well. And Section 20 is the reporting requirements. And then you've got the enactment dates, which would make these enact the 120th day after the effective date of this act. This would be so that there'd have lag time to make sure we notify all the distributors of what their new requirements are. So that's 2094. I want to then, you guys have a lot of amendments, and I've made a packet of them. I'm going to hand out. I waited to hand out so you guys wouldn't.
Senator Burdick.
That was why.
Okay. So, yeah, there's also an emergency clause for part of the act, except for sections 11 and 12.
Correct. Okay. Now Pete has also done.
Whose handwriting is on there?
That's my work product. That's attorney-client work product. Also known as chicken scratching.
Safe, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Read it.
I want to draw your attention to Pete has done a kind of a breakdown of the amendments for 2094, and he put them in order because actually as you go through my list, some of these no one is currently supporting. So if you look at his list, he suggests that we look at A10 first, which I believe is appropriate. So if you look in your packet, complete with my hen scratchings, A10 is Mr. Gardner's amendment that deals with the criminal sanctions and makes it clear that these who these apply to, that they apply to the non-participating, non-compliant manufacturers. So if you look at this, this would be amending page 4 of the A. Engrossed bill. And I would categorize these as technical amendments to making clear who these apply to. They apply to the non-participating. It said to about tobacco product manufacturers, so it would be the non-participating manufacturers. And also allows a civil penalty and makes it clear that there would be a civil penalty, again, for violations. And then in the bottom of the amendment, the 10 amendment, would allow destruction of the cigarettes that are forfeited if a person is, again, if a distributor is not using this list, this directory, and is not affixing stamps properly, if we take those cigarettes, they can be destroyed.
So, in other words, extra food we donate to a food bank, but we aren't going to be donating cigarettes to charity or anything like that. Right.
No, Senator Walker, and I think that this making that clear, I assume, is kind of you can see where it says notwithstanding section 16 and 17 of chapter 666, 2001. Again, that's the criminal forfeiture stuff we worked on last section.
666.
It is also 666.
Appropriate.
The A9 amendments is the second one that we were going to look at according to Pete's list. And this is the Tobacco Enforcement Fund. that is established separate and distinct from the general fund. And I believe this is the AG's amendment would allow this fund and monies to be appropriated into it. It would be distinct from the general fund. And if you look at the second page of the amendment, the sum of $700,000 shall be transferred from the tobacco settlement funds account to the enforcement fund. And then also, this would, as I understand it from reading it, would be also replenished by monies from enforcement, of enforcing these different rules about the lists and the distributions. That is, I'm sure Pete Shepherd is here for that amendment.
Question.
Yes.
Down in the notes section, it says this amendment is not related in any way to funding for the tobacco tax compliant task force. That issue is addressed in 2386. Is that not 2368?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mark, I think I might have the numbers flipped on that.
Okay, so that's
the other bill is the tax compliance bill.
Okay, and that's the one that John Valley and Courtney Dresser testified to. They had some concerns.
Yes, correct.
About.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, well, then correct. I'll talk about it when you get there.
We're not putting an amendment on this bill, but we're putting it on 2368.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Sternberg, the two bills have two funds. This bill and the funding, again, is to enforce these portions about these escrow accounts, the distribution lists, et cetera. 2368, there is a fund on that one, and that is that's the system we had for the enforcement that DOJ spoke to.
Okay, so
more generally, I should say, the more general enforcement provisions.
Right, so this one doesn't... Does this $700,000, does part of that come out of prevention money? I don't think so. Looks like it comes out of the tobacco settlement, not from the tobacco tax.
Right. That says draws funds from MSA payments.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. So that's the A9. The A5 amendments is the next to look at. This is what's been referred to as the allocable share amendment. And this is proposed by Philip Morris. Mr. Gardner's here. Mr. Nelson's here. This is opposed by what we've been calling small tobacco. Marshall Cobas here. Bill Cross is here for small tobacco or non-participating. I don't know how to articulate these things except for with the way we refer to them. Again, this is probably the issue that we've heard a lot about. This would make, for the escrow accounts, you would put money into escrow, and again, these escrow accounts are based on how many cigarettes are sold throughout the country. And this would rather focus on the account of suits sold in Oregon, so that you would put into escrow based on sales in Oregon rather than across the country, which would adjust the amount that goes into escrow, because obviously some manufacturers sell in some states. And I think we heard from pretty much everybody on that, and I'm sure you've heard from people since then.
For the committee, I think what I want to try to do is I want to try to adopt the amendments that the committee can agree on today on these bills, and then get a Hammond Gross version accomplished, and then bring them back for final action. So I guess at this juncture, we're in work session. We've got the A9s, A10s, A5s.
We're in work session on both bills. Did you open the work session?
We're going to work session on 2094. So what I'd like to do, I guess, is take up the consideration of the A9, A10, and the A5s.
Mr. Chairman, would it be productive to move the A9 and 10 together and then have a separate motion on the A5s?
That works.
Okay, I move the dash A9 and A10 amendments to House Bill 2094.
Verdi moves the adoption of the A9 and A10 amendments to House Bill 2094. Is there any discussion?
I don't think we had any testimony in opposition to either of these amendments.
You would know because you're on the picture here.
I did, and Mr. Chair, that day I was gone on the 11th. I did get the video.
Any further discussion?
And I sat and took 11 pages of notes. So I'm going to have a question for Mr. Shepherd.
All right.
But not on these two amendments.
All right. Any objection to the motion?
Mr. Chair?
A9, A10. Senator.
I would appreciate some clarification on where that $700,000 comes from. This says it draws funds from the MSA payments, but exactly
where that is.
So who's losing?
Do you know, Pete?
Who's not getting that $700,000?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if we have someone from LFO here sitting in the back.
I think it depends on what the legislature ultimately does.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. The Master Pete Shepherd, Deputy Attorney General, the Master Settlement Agreement proceeds are unrestricted by their terms, so they come to the state without any strings attached. The legislature has previously created an account, and I think it's called the Master Settlement Agreement account, which is sort of the suspense account into which all funds received pursuant to the Master Settlement Agreement are, that's where they first arrive when they're wired to the state of Oregon pursuant to each payment that's due. Then from that account, the legislature has provided for the allocation of those funds, and basically there are two. One current application of those has to do with some bonds issued for development at the OHSU, and then the remainder just provides that whatever's in that account goes into the general fund. So I think that from a technical budgeting standpoint, the answer is, I suppose that $700,000 comes out of the general fund. And as I indicated in my notes, these have been accounted for in as we understand it, in our budget process down in ways.
And I think you'll remember during the special sessions, we had a certain amount of this MSA money that was kind of set aside, or in some cases anticipated to be coming in within the biennium. It had not yet been received. And then I think at one point, FEOC was funded with some of this money, and now I think in the current budget, it's funded with general fund or cigarette tax.
All right. Further discussion?
Yes. Mr. Shepherd.
Not so fast.
Thank you. Because I'd forgotten. You know, the CITMA, the independent tobacco people, wanted to set up a task force for looking at the MSA. And I'm kind of not wanting to do another task force, but I think we need to have more information about what's going on in the MSA. Can that be rolled into the function of this enforcement fund, or is that just way off the mark?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if I can suggest that the issue of the task force is addressed in relation to various amendments proposed in House Bill 2368,
okay.
As you pointed out, I had a typo in my other materials. And again, Master Settlement Agreement funds are unrestricted, and the legislature can appropriate them or provide for them however it wishes.
Well, for me, it's not so much what we do with the money, it's what's going on in that bureaucratic mess that was created for the MSA to cover all the states. I just feel like we don't know what's going on. And I wanted some input in that, and I don't know if I don't think that can be accomplished through this little enforcement fund that you're creating here, but we'll talk about it in the next bill.
All right, further discussion on the motion to adopt the A9 and A10 amendment. Any objections? No objection. Motion passes. All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I would move the -5 amendments to House Bill 2094.
Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the A5 amendments to House Bill 2094. Discussion.
But I need Mr.
Lots.
Shepherd.
It's nice to be needed, isn't it?
Always a pleasure, sir. Mr. Chair, again, Pete Shepherd, Department of Justice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shepherd. As I indicated, I watched the video where you testified on the 11th. And then I've had lobbyists ad nauseum in my office on this bill. I have a couple questions about this -5. There were really a lot of certified smart attorneys involved in drafting the MSA, so I'm just having a little trouble understanding how this loophole could have escaped their attention, and I'm putting loophole in quotes. I'd like you to address that comment. And then you also testified at that hearing and also have noted in the notes here that this A5 is not essential to accomplish this bill, and that if we don't adopt them this session, they'll probably be necessary next session. But you didn't really explain that very well in your testimony, so could you address those two things?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, first with respect to the question of how conceivably this issue could have been missed, as indeed is my belief it was. And I think the best answer to that, given that I have to tell you that I was not at that table, so I don't know, and indeed the negotiations that gave rise to the text of the Master Settlement Agreement were done by a smaller group of attorneys general that didn't include the Oregon Attorney General. So I have to give you, there's a certain amount of guesswork involved in my answer, but the best explanation that I can assign to this is simply that both the attorneys general and the companies that were negotiating for the settlement of the pending lawsuits, the only model they had was for companies that did business universally in all states. And there was a certain degree of what I think would be fairly described by an outside observer of arrogance that everybody involved at that table thought that because they all were dealing with a nationwide issue, that necessarily the industry would always look like that in the future. I think that's how I understand this, what I frankly think is probably an error in drafting originally crept into the Master Settlement Agreement. But as I say, Senator Walker, that's informed just by my outsider's view of that process, and that's why I say I think that's a probably a fairly reasonable explanation of why it is that this was overlooked in the original drafting.
But Mr. Shepard, if I continue, Mr. Chair, there were SPMs had the opportunity to join the MSA within 90 days, and MPMs didn't want to. They chose not to for reasons of their own. And some of these SPMs that joined, they aren't paying anything in. Or the ones that came afterwards, if they joined within 90 days, didn't they get an exemption under the MSA from paying in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, no, I think that every manufacturer who participates in a Master Settlement Agreement is obliged to pay, and I think that's correct. There may be others here who have more information on that question. And it's still competent even today for a manufacturer to join the Master Settlement Agreement.
So I have some information here that says that Commonwealth Tobacco signed the MSA within 90 days and gets an exemption and doesn't pay into the MSA. Are you aware of that?
Madam Chair, Senator Walker, I don't know that. I don't have specific knowledge of Commonwealth Tobacco, so I can't address that, but it is my understanding that everybody who participates in the Master Settlement Agreement shares in the burdens of that.
Okay. And my other question to you was now, what did I say? If we don't adopt this now, we're going to have to do it next session. Explain why that would be the case.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, if the NPMs are able by application of the current Master Settlement Agreement and of the current NPM law, if they are able to enjoy a competitive advantage and during the next X number of months or years over their competitors who are participating in the Master Settlement Agreement, and that gets to be an accelerating trend because of their capacity to make use of the allocable share loophole, if you will, or option under the law, then that does carry the potential for undermining ultimately payments that otherwise would be payable under the master settlement agreement. And it's so my suggestion that this would be a greater necessity potentially in 2 years derives from the possibility that that will be an accelerating trend fundamentally.
And Mr. Shepard, isn't it true that one of the states that has passed this did so with a delayed implementation date?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, it is my understanding that that one of the states passed a version of the A5 amendments, the allocable share cap, that is in some way conditioned on the number of other states that also pass a similar piece of legislation. And there are versions of the allocable share cap that have been passed that do have, as I understand it, affect delayed implementation dates or other conditions that are attached to the effectiveness of those caps. For example, it's my understanding that one of the states passed an allocable share cap that depends upon whether neighboring states also adopt an allocable share cap. So states that have adopted allocable share caps have done so in a variety of formats. And again, probably there are others here who have the intricate details of each of those various versions.
Mm-hmm. And our neighboring states, Washington, Idaho, I had that list somewhere. Do you know?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I know that Washington has approved an allocable share cap, and I recall that there was testimony as to the status in other states, but frankly, I don't remember what the report was.
Okay. And according to this document you presented at the hearing from the National Association of Attorneys General, it looks, like a generic allocable share amendment discussion. And it says that, according to NAG, that we stand on legal grounds by enacting the allocable share, that it is constitutional. And I assume you would agree to that because you belong to NAG.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, we think the allocable share cap, if you were to choose to enact it into law, is defensible, and we would propose to defend it. The just so the record is clear, that submission, though it does come from the National Association of Attorneys General, actually was not submitted to the committee by me. It was one of the other lobbyists. Nonetheless, I take the point, and we would defend and believe that the allocable share cap, the A5 amendments, if you chose to do it, would be defensible, though they would be attacked.
All right. Additional questions, or are you
just
wrapped up here?
One more. Do you see any value in delaying implementation of the Dash 5?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, our view from the beginning on the allocable share cap is that we need the bill more desperately than we need the allocable share cap. If inclusion of the A5 were to endanger the bill, then my answer to you is you should not do the A5s, because to the Department of Justice the bill is more important. That's why we say the A5s are not essential. As an abstract policy question, my answer to you is no, there's no reason to delay doing an allocable share of some form if you ultimately as I think you ultimately will need to, there's no reason to delay. Again, our frank evaluation of that is that we want to make sure that we don't endanger the bill itself, because in the hierarchy of things that we think are critically important, the bill is more critically important than the allocable share.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Shepard. I appreciate that.
All right. Further discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, just one brief question. If you did any kind of estimate on how much more money would likely come into the escrow accounts if the allocable share amendment is adopted?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we have not. I know that other parties have done that. I think that Mr. Nelson, for example, submitted some data to the committee, and I've reviewed that, and I didn't see anything in his methodology that seemed incorrect to me, but we have not independently tried to make such a calculation.
Thank you.
All right. Further discussion?
Any objections to the adoption of the A5 amendment?
Mr. Chair, I am having so much angst about this because we have this sick alliance with tobacco. It really is truly a sick one, and it's very unfortunate. And it's clear that big tobacco, quote unquote, is pursuing this not for, I can't believe they're doing it just for the benefit of the state's general fund. And our shares, they want to increase the price of cigarettes of the NPMs. I think the testimony has been that Big Tobacco raised their prices on their cigarettes to far exceed what was necessary to cover payments under the MSA. So it's just this escalating sick thing that we've got going here, and I don't like it.
I guess my argument back to you is I don't distinguish between big tobacco and little tobacco.
Well, no, they're all bad.
And I think that if you have one party that is escaping what would otherwise be appropriate payments, then they ought to be brought in line. I kind of agree with you to the extent that the legislature finds itself in a relationship with these companies that perhaps we'd rather not have, but that's kind of a vicarious result of attorneys general involving themselves in large, massive lawsuits that have contracted the states in these discussions. So I think it's our public duty to make sure that the revenues that are derived from that are maximized to the fullest extent possible. So I think it's our duty to do that. Senator Ringo.
Still a comment, Mr. Chair. I mean, I think Senator Walker's exactly right. I mean, this will be a mechanism that will raise the cost of cigarettes on little tobacco. But that's not a bad thing. You're right. Big tobacco wants that to happen for competitive reasons, but if that makes it more expensive for certain groups of people to obtain cigarettes in Oregon, that's fine with me.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, studies have shown that price has a real impact on teenage smoking. So I'm just trying to make Senator Walker feel better because I feel the same way. You have to kind of put yourself in a different dimension to consider these bills.
Well, I guess I'm a reform smoker, and that's probably the worst kind.
I am too, Senator Walker.
I gave it up in 1974 and never looked back.
It's the same year I gave it up.
I look virgin-esque. I've never smoked, right?
Are you serious?
Never smoked.
My husband has never smoked either. That's why I gave it up when I met him. You know, I gave him up for a man, and we're still married.
You know,
after 28 years.
Any further discussion on the A5
amendment?
Is there any objection
great.
To the adoption of the A5 amendment?
Well, just tacit objection. I reviewed this. And
are you saying no? Or yes? Or you're not comfortable?
No.
Okay. Senator Walker would be noted as a no. There are sufficient votes to adopt the amendment. The motion passes. We're beyond our committee time. We're going to bring these back on Wednesday. And I'll have asked staff to put this bill together, 2094, to the extent that we have adopted amendments and a working copy in front of us. With that, any other business before the committee? If not, we're adjourned. Wednesday?